Hi, my name is John Schwabish. I'm an economist at the Congressional Budget Office. And in addition to my regular responsibilities there, I do research on immigration, food stamps, inequality, social security, etc. I'm one of a small team responsible for the agency's data visualization efforts, and I also help other analysts and colleagues work on their presentation skills. I also run a series of workshops on data visualization and presentation techniques, and they're geared mainly towards people working in the government sector and in public policy sector, so think tanks and policy shops, hence the name Policy Viz. But tonight I'm going to talk to you about a project I've been working on for a couple of months, something I call the graphic continuum. And the graphic continuum is basically my thought process about the state space of graphics and data visualization in general. How graphics relate to one another, how a column chart relates to a line, relates to a square, relates to a circle. And I thought I would come and show you this nonlinear space. So this is a picture of my office wall. And this is a few weeks ago. So working with all of these different graphic types, it's inherently nonlinear, so it's sort of hard to talk about in front of an audience. So I'm going to try to take sort of a slice of that continuum, and I'm going to put it into a linear narrative. And to do so, I'm going to use one of my kids' books. If you have kids, you may be familiar with the If You Give a Moose a Muffin books. And also If You Give a Pig a Pancake, and If You Give a Mouse a Cupcake. These books are basically used cascading storytelling techniques, in which, in this book in particular, the kid gives a moose a muffin, and the moose then wants some jelly, and then wants another muffin, and another muffin. And then they have to make more muffins, so they have to go to the store, and to get to the store, they have to wear jackets, and they have to do all these things. So it's a cascading storytelling device. So I'm going to try to use this device to tell you about a slice of this project I've been working on, and I'm not going to use a moose. So to tell you this story of this project I've been working on, I'm going to tell you about If You Give a Nerd a Number. So if you give a nerd a number, he might want a table to go with it. And if he has a table, he might want to add more and more numbers. But to start, he'll focus on one number. And that will remind him that he can plot that number in some graphic space. And he can add another number and another number and lots more numbers. And this will remind him that he can change the space itself and maybe think of a stacked area chart or a normalized area chart, or think about different shapes, maybe a paired column chart or a stacked column chart. And then he could, of course, rotate that space and make a paired bar chart or a stacked bar chart. Or he could go back to that line plot and add more and more data. And he could perhaps think about plotting it in small multiples or spark lines. And this to remind him that he might just want to look at those endpoints, and so he could plot it as a slope chart. Again, he could rotate the axes and think about it as a dot plot. And all of this would remind him that there's uncertainty with data and uncertainty with graph types, and that might remind him of a fan chart or a box and whisker plot. And he could go back to that line graph, and if he had two y-axes, that might remind him of correlations, of which would remind him, of course, of a scatter plot. And he could add, encode another level of data, maybe make a bubble chart, or the unfortunate 3D bubble chart. Or he might combine that correlation in lines and come up with a parallel coordinates plot, or use another shape, make a radar chart. Or he might go back to the lines and the scatter plot and come up with one of those line scatter plots. And the combination of the circles and the lines may remind him of a network diagram, or a node plot, or a hive chart. And the curves in the hive might remind him of a chord chart. And those arcs, of course, may remind him of an arc chart. And that may lead him to think about a sequential arc chart, in which time goes from A to B, or B to C, or A to C. And now he's thinking about time, so he might think about a flow chart, or a tree layout, or very simply a timeline. Or alternatively, he might think about a Gantt plot, or very simply a calendar. And this may remind him that he can think about time and combine it with a circle and create a nightingale. And of course, the nightingale sort of looks like an exploded circle, so he may try to bring that back in, and that will remind him of a pie chart. Which, of course, unfortunately, He could do 3D. Or he could explode, or he could punch a hole in the middle of it, or explode it again, or cut it in half. But all of those are variations on that theme of a circle. And this might remind him to think about other shapes, like a square, and create a tree map. Or break that tree map apart and think about a square cloud. Or tack them together and create a unit chart. And the unit chart may remind him that he can think about other shapes. And so that may remind him of a glyph plot. And all those people may remind him of high-frequency data, which might lead him to a heat map, or a contour map, or the unfortunate 3D contour map. And thinking about contour maps may lead him to think about maps with which he could add circles, or squares, or lines. And having looked at the map with connections on it, he may think about where he is currently standing talking to you about graphics, which leads to one particular point. And of course, you could take that point and plot it in an x-y space. And so if you gave a nerd a graph, he might want a number to go with it. So that's a project I'm working on and continue working on. And I thank you for listening.
So.
You've already done that part.
So, Rob, yeah, Robert.
Slow moving.
Good.
Good evening.
Good evening?
No.
Anyone? All right, right on. I was like, oh crap, I'm dead already. Actually, before I start, I noticed that at these meetups, like, the organizers never get a round of applause. And these guys, like, every meetup that I've gone to has been awesome. So. Right on. All right, so. Okay? Yes, sir. All right. So, my name is Robert Dempsey. And I'm going to talk about understanding clients better through data. And actually, in case you're wondering what happened to my foot, you might not be it, but it's a freak Fitbit competition accident. Nothing major, that's why I can still hop along with it pretty quick. Get some weird looks walking down the street there, let me tell you. Okay, so I am the Director of Engagement at Intridia, which is a really nice way of saying I do marketing and sales. And so I was talking with a guy before in describing what it was I did, and he's like, you sound like a growth hacker. And I'm like, that sounds like a much better label than marketer and salesperson. So I'm like, okay, so what the heck does that mean? And I found this great definition on the next web. And basically, growth hackers utilize analytical thinking, product engineering, blah, blah, blah. You can read it. Essentially, I'm a geek with an MBA, which makes me doubly dangerous. So I work in Intridia. We do custom web and mobile applications. We're really in the enterprise space doing Ruby on Rails, some of the latest stuff we've done. We got ADP, the payroll company, very cool. So we're doing work for them, Verizon, McKinsey. We did a site for Amazon. People like that are who we work with. So I joined the company a little more than 3 months ago, and I walked in pretty blind. I was new to the company. We have over 100 existing clients. We had, all of the clients for the most part had, social networks. We have social networking accounts. And the way that we get our clients is both top-down and bottom-up. So what I mean by that is that I'm talking with typically C-level people. Yes, even dressed like this, we do get to work from home. And so I dress like this all the time. Be jealous. So that's top-down. But then bottom-up also is a lot of what I'm really happy to see is a lot of companies, like, we did a project for Opower. And when Opower wanted to do, to contract out, the first thing they did was they talked to their development team. And they're like, hey, who do you all want to work with? So that's cool. So we do a lot of stuff in the open source community. And so I go to, like, a lot of meetups, Ruby and Python and all that. So, because we're really in the development community. And the biggest thing, though, for me was that there was not nearly enough information in our existing content management system about clients. When I say not much, I say like nothing. Like literally there was nothing. Like we had some stuff in Salesforce and then they moved to this other thing. So basically I was starting from scratch. Right? So I walk in, we got all these clients, I'm like, oh crap. What do I do? So I need to figure out, well, how do I reach these people? But I don't want to be like this guy, because no one freaking likes salespeople like this guy, especially in the tech world. So I had a theory. I'm like, all right, I can use data about all of our clients, and I can find more people like them because I'll know all sorts of stuff about them. Yes, I talk to them as well, so don't get me wrong. It's not like pure data. I do talk to people. But also, you know, the more I can find out, the better I can connect with people and the more of clients I can get. So these were my goals. I wanted to better understand our clients through data and conversations. I want to use that information to create content, tools, and events for similar companies and people. So again, that goes back also to like a lot of the open source work that we do. We have like 50-some projects on GitHub. Code that I'll talk about today is starting to get up there. I'm open sourcing all my code and all that. But at the end of the day, I do work for the CEO, and he demands that I get more clients, else I get fired. So that's what it's really all about is bottom line, I need to get more clients. So this is how I went about the whole thing. I code in two primary languages, Ruby and Python, and I use for visualization, I use Tableau, which, yes, it's Windows, but I like keep Windows where it belongs in a nice virtual machine on my Mac, and so then I run Tableau that way. So I use Tableau, I use Python also, which probably a lot of y'all use for, you know, data munging, all sorts of data fun, and also R to, you know, a lesser extent, but really plotting anything in R is extremely simple once you have the data like in a really good format. So I use R for that also. So for storing all of this stuff, I use MongoDB because I needed something that was schemaless that I can just shove all sorts of data into. And so the sources of data, speaking of which, are from our content management system, which now I'm building up. I get data from Twitter, LinkedIn, Google Analytics, and Surfiki. And Surfiki is actually a data product that we came up with that you can go and check out. It's free. We have a developer API for it. But essentially what we're doing is we're scanning. Right now, as an example, with Surfiki, we scan the surface web like 80,000 plus sources, and then just gather like crap tons of info, and it does all sorts of analysis, kind of all your standard analyses that you can think of. So from Surfiki.com also, I'm getting, the type of data, let me start over, the type of data that I'm getting from each of my sources is as follows. Right, so from Twitter, I'm getting all of the tweets and account mentions for a set of accounts that I have. So for instance, what I'll do is, if we get a new lead, one of the first things I do is build out their profile. I get their LinkedIn, Google+, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. I then add their account. I get the ID for that account and add it to this growing list. So basically, if anyone mentions that account, or if that account says anything on Twitter, I get all of that. And from Twitter, and that just goes into my Mongo database, which is pretty cool. From LinkedIn, I'm scraping company and personal profile information, or I should say business profile information, since it's a business. Google Analytics, I pull data out of there too, because some of their charts and trying to get the data in the way that I want is just stupid and annoying, so I pull it out and do it myself. And so I get like content, what content are people viewing, keywords, location data, etc. And then from Surfiki, we actually create this product called Refine, which allows you to, which is open source on GitHub, anyone can use it. And I use it to basically take data out of Surfiki. What it's for is, it was developed to basically sit on top of Elasticsearch and allow you to like pull out and refine data as it comes out. So I also get stuff out of our CMS, etc. So this is the data flow, basically everything I mentioned going into Mongo, coming out the other end in visualization. So Mongo blobs, get that. So from Surfiki, this is kind of what I get out of it, which is pretty cool. So I get like clients, any mention of them, and all sorts of analytics about it. I can actually show you this slide later so you can read it. But let's see some chart goodness in Tableau. So first I create a tree map, because after I scraped LinkedIn for all of our clients and saw, okay, what industries are they in, what company size, how much revenue, blah, 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 I'm like, all right, I need to do some exploratory data analysis here. So I create a tree map to see who these people are. We work with a lot of companies in internet and IT. The next thing I did was I created a little map. This is all like extremely simple in Tableau if you've ever used it. So I'm like, okay, now I want to see where these people are. So Virginia, which is good because we're here. We have an office like two blocks up from the White House. A lot of people in California. We work with startups and whatnot from there. So that's that. I then wanted to see company size. So I created a little graph saying, okay, who are these people? So we work with a lot of big companies, which is good. Like, we're pretty much in the enterprise, so that validated that one right there. Wanted to look at the company size, public, privately held, et cetera, in nice pie charts. This, which is completely unreadable, is basically industry by states, which is fun. And then this is from a completely separate program called Follower Wonk, which shows where your Twitter followers are on Earth, which is great. So, stuff I'm not doing and I won't get into because I see that I've run out of time and I don't want to stomp on other speakers is basically a lot of this stuff is automated. I'm further automating it so I can just like automatically change, say, like the amount of Twitter accounts that I'm following. I can just say, hey, here's another one, and the program deals with it instead of having to like stop a script and restart and just, you know, a lot of manual stuff. Correlating client intelligence with more Google Analytics data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then basically this is me. So that's it. I'm out of time. Thank you very much. Ooh, one more thing, too. I have like 5 of these cool untreated water bottles. They're metal. They're good. They're great for biking. And if anyone wants one, I have like 5. So come and get one.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert.
Technical difficulties. So you shouldn't need to get out of the box anymore. You already did that.
Okay, so Kevin could come up now. Next speaker is Kevin Coogan. Thanks. So the company name is Amalgamood, and basically what we do is we use Hadoop and the Hadoop ecosystem for financial market analysis. I actually spoke at the Hadoop Summit, which was just about a month ago. So the Hadoop Summit was just about a month ago. And while I was out there, I went to the Graph Lab workshop. And basically what I'm going to talk about today are just some takeaways that I got from these two conferences. The Hadoop Summit had about 2,500 people, which is a lot of people for one conference, but the growth rate is considerably slowed down, so I think it was probably about 10% more than last year. In contrast, the Graph Lab workshop, which is basically about machine learning and graph analytics, almost doubled in size. So these observations more or less parallel some of my thoughts on what's going to happen in the big data space. And for the rest of the talk, I'm going to discuss more or less some of these thoughts. So some of the broad takeaways. HDFS is now the assumed default for big data, and that's been going on for pretty much the last 6 months to a year. But last year when I went to the Hadoop Summit, that really wasn't the case. It was much more, the future wasn't as well known. This year there's a lot more corporate presence, so a lot more people in suits. Last year was much more developer focused. And the average sales pitch this year is basically we make it easy. Graph Lab is pretty interesting. For those of you who don't know, they recently raised $6 million in round A financing. Their pitch is pretty much around machine learning is now leaving academia, and they need to make it easy for everybody else to use, meaning those people outside of academia. The development stages for big data, and this is very much along the lines of like a private equity type observations. I used to work in private equity. How I see things developing is that they're going to happen in 5 stages. The first is big data infrastructure, then making it easy, integrating familiar tools, big data specific tools and verticals or sector specific. So for the first stage, I think this is pretty much over for the time being.
And these companies are very well established. Probably you'll see a couple of IPOs of these companies over the next couple of years. And I think that's going to be the next big news in big data in general. When Cloudera has an IPO, I think that's going to attract a lot of attention. Not that big data is not getting attention now, but I think that's going to be one of the next big milestones. The second big focus area is making it easy. And we've seen a lot of startups focus on this space recently. And especially at the Hadoop Summit, most of the new companies revolved around integrating familiar tools. So big data is great, but at the beginning there wasn't a lot of focus on things like security and SQL. And a lot of the startups right now are focusing on things like SQL. Specifically, SQL is getting a lot of attention. And that should bring in a lot more corporate clients. For the Graph Lab workshop was much more based around what I'm saying the stage four is, which is more around machine learning and graph analysis and real big data visualization. A lot of people talk about Tableau being like a big data tool. And I think increasingly you'll have unique visualizations built around big data. So a lot of what Tableau does is not true big data visualizations, but I think this next stage is coming through. And these companies, Graph Lab recently raised some money, and this, I don't know how to pronounce it, the IASD, they raised, I think, $30 million. Before that, they raised something like $15 million, so they're doing quite well. And this Neo4j, they're pretty active around around DC. But essentially, from what I saw at the conferences, this stage four, these big data-specific tools are really starting to take off, and they're really the ones generating the most attention right now, whereas Hadoop is probably starting to become more corporate and starting to level out some. And the last stage for development, I think, is going to be around verticals or sector-specific companies. And I think this is where big data applications are really going to become very exciting, because you're going to take people with domain knowledge, whether it be in agriculture or healthcare or education, and they're going to apply a lot of these big data tools to domain-specific problems. And this this stage really hasn't taken off yet, but I think it will very soon. And this is the area where if you go to the Hadoop Summit or a machine learning conference in the next year or two, I think a lot of these companies are going to start to appear more and more at these conferences. And I think that's it.
Great. Our next speaker is Patrick Wagstrom from IBM Research.
Yes. Can you clip this on? Then I'll hand you the computer.
Oh, yeah. That works.
And this should work. Well, actually, I was wondering if this is probably going to play that. If there's not, I'll do it.
Oh. All right. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you guys about how to abuse the GitHub API, or at least abuse it within an inch of its life, to learn a lot about your open source project. So I'm a data scientist, software engineer, research staff member, whatever you're going to call me at IBM Research. Primarily, I work in a group called Software Governance. What that means is that we look at how to make software development not suck, and we look at how to do it specifically from a way that people work together. So let's start out with a bit of a story. A couple of months ago, I was looking and I was having some problems with R, and I'm like, man, R is slow. R is really, really slow. So what else is out there? What's the new hotness? Because, well, I guess R is sort of passe now. So I go and I do some Googling, and I discover this programming language called Julia. So like most people, when I'm evaluating an open source project, I go to the homepage, and I read lots about it and everything, and I can say, oh, well, you know, there's some nice benchmarks down here, and it lets me, you know, sort of see what's going on with it, and, you know, I've got, you know, some nice comparisons, but I have no idea, you know, if this is just, you know, a couple of nerds somewhere that were able to put together a really good web page, and it's just like two guys working in their basement doing this whole product. So I have no idea if I'm going to start playing around with this, if it makes sense for me. So what do? I go and I hop on and I go and look at their GitHub page, and their GitHub page kind of lets me do what we call smelling the code. You know, and it lets me see what's actually in the code. But it's very high level. So this is a very technical sort of process that we're talking about here. So I can see, you know, it's made up of a couple of different programming languages, and, you know, there's some files and everything like that. And I can see it's got 10,000 commits, which means, you know, this is not something that's, you know, obscenely tiny or anything. But this is all still very, very technical. And the problem that we have is that, you know, software is actually made out of people. Software is always built by people. Most times when software fails, it's because of people. That's sort of the assertion that our group makes. And, you know, and that's all good, but, you know, if we go back to, you know, what is it, 17th century English literature, we know that, you know, if software is made out of people and no man is an island, well, then what does that tell us about the software itself? Well, if we want to consider, should we be using a project, should we be looking at it, we need to look at the bigger picture. So let's talk about how you can look at the bigger picture and what the bigger picture means. So here is the bigger picture. Oops, how did I miss it? Okay, here is the bigger picture. So what is this? This is looking at the Ruby on Rails ecosystem. And this is kind of insightful because it tells you, oh my gosh, Ruby on Rails, which is where that little red thing that's way up there is connected to all these different projects by shared developers. And it connects to hundreds and hundreds and thousands of projects on GitHub, and some of which are very, very big. Like over here in this big yellow thing that you can't really see on the edge there, that's actually jQuery. So you can follow a chain of developers there. And what that gives me a good idea about is, how do people work together? What are some of the related technologies that I'm looking at? Is this sort of, you know, off on its own little island of quirkiness, also known as the functional programming island, you know? Or is this sort of more mainstream? I see that there's one or two people who have a humor about functional programming. That's good. So at IBM, and in conjunction with the University of Nebraska, we've developed the tool. And you can tell by the lack of a good logo which tool it is that we've developed, called GitMiner. And what GitMiner does is it connects to GitHub using their API, and it downloads all the information you'd ever want to know about a project, and all the people on it, and every project that they look at, and every project that they look at, until basically it has sucked in everything that you can possibly get from GitHub at a rate of 5,000 requests per hour, or whatever GitHub it allows you to do. And it does this using some really neat technology from an open source project called Tinkerpop. And Tinkerpop is very big in the graph database space. So I'm glad the last speaker actually mentioned Neo4j, because they're one of the big graph players and everything. So it uses a framework called Blueprints that allows us to store it into a graph database. So you can think of Blueprints as being a little bit like SQL for graph databases. So within IBM, we've done this, and we have, I don't know, on the order of, you know, 50 or so terabytes of data from GitHub that we've pulled down. We haven't stored in a Titan database. But for the purpose of this talk, I'm just going to be talking about Julia and a little Neo4j database that I've done of about 500 megabytes of understanding Julia. So the first thing that we wanted to look at is, you know, we wanted to look at, if people are developing on Julia itself, what else are they working on? You know, what are other things that the people are interested in? So what we can do with this tool is we can go and we can say, all right, start off with Julia over here. Give me all the developers. There's actually 133 people who have committed code who have direct contributor access to Julia, not including all the other people who have added code to it. And show me what other projects they're working on. So we can see that Diego Zea, I don't know how to say these guys' names, but, you know, he's also working on metadata.jl. And Static Float's working on a couple of different projects, Julia Lang, example, you know, libuv, tk.jl. So we get an idea of sort of how's the distribution of what people are working on. Is there actually a community that's going on here? And in fact, you know, this is pretty good. It says, you know, yeah, there's a pretty good community. But here we're looking really only at Julia type thing. So we're like, well, it's good to know what people actually develop, but we want to know what are they really interested in, what are they passionate about, what might influence the project. So we went a step further, and on GitHub, you know, you can click that little star project thing, and, you know, you wonder, well, what's that good for? Well, if you start a project, I probably know about it, and it's a little creepy, but anyway, so we can go through and we can look through here and we can say, well, what if people actually starred? So in the case of this, it used to be called Watch a Project. They changed the name. I haven't changed the name of the program yet. But we can look and we can say, well, what have they actually starred? What have they watched? And we can aggregate that across all the developers. And what this does is this gives us a really good idea of the other interesting technologies that are out there that the developers of Julia are really excited about. So we go through and we do that sort of analysis and everything like that. And, you know, we can see that, you know, there's a program called Julia Studio, which is a very nice IDE for the Julia programming language that you might want to look at. There's some stuff to call some Python, a bunch of stuff that I don't know about, some stuff to use some data frames, and some stuff to use linear algebra solvers and everything like that. And so this says, well, these are the sort of ideas that are influencing the core Julia developers. And this helps us kind of get a smell for the code, a smell for the social process of what's going on. But let's say that we want to go a bit further. So we do what everybody does, and we go and we plot it on a ball and a stick mess and everything like that. And in this case, I want to know, you know, so let's look at some of these top things. So we flip back to the last chart, and let's take one of the ones that was the highest. And let's just take dataframes.jl. And we can zoom in and we can actually go and look at dataframes.jl, so you can't see it all that closely. And I can't really point up here, so I think I can use the mouse. So dataframes.jl is right there. And we can select it, and then we can go and we can expand it, and we can see, well, who are the people who actually know about that? And what that allows us to do is it allows us to go very, very deep and understand this stuff. And I can say, huh, if I'm trying to learn about this stuff, well, who really should I be talking to about it, who I might know? And in this case, I see that it's Harlan. So, you know, I can go and I can talk to Harlan. I can get some other perspective on the tool and everything like that by using this tool. So what it does is it provides a very rich way to get some in-depth analysis of the social side of software engineering. So if you're interested, all the stuff's online. You can go download the data set. There's a nice Git repository that I put up there with instructions on how to do the same exact analysis I did and some other fun analysis. And go have at it. Thanks.
Hey, Aline, if you can come up here. So our next presenter is, I think, is it Aline or Elena?
Elena, sorry.
Elena Jaliva.
Ways working. Put that on.
Hi.
Clip it on.
Can you hear me?
Clip it onto your. Click on your shirt.
Okay. Can you guys hear me? Okay. Yeah. Okay. I actually prefer to talk without microphones, but I'm not sure that would work.
No.
No.
Okay. So I'll not try then.
Okay, cool. Okay, so I'm Elena, and I'm a data scientist at Living Social, which is a company which is headquartered here in D.C., and it serves as a marketplace for local and national e-commerce. Maybe some of you are familiar with it. So I'm going to present some work which was a joint work with Joe Pfeiffer, who is a PhD student in computer science at Purdue University and did an internship with us last summer. Okay, so to start with, the bottom is cut off a little bit. Anyway, to start with, as you all know, people have always shared ideas, thoughts, and information with each other. So just because we have social media these days doesn't mean that something new is actually happening. People have always liked to share with each other. However, unlike traditional broadcasting media, social media allows people to actually share content with each other. So there isn't just one source of information. It's not like a newspaper where everyone goes and reads the same information. People can go and read many different people's information. And a recent New York Times study reveals some of the motivations behind why people share with each other. So I'm going to read those because I don't remember them. But number one is to bring valuable and entertaining content to others. Second is to define ourselves to others. The third one is to grow and nourish relationships. Fourth one is for self-fulfillment. And the fifth one is to market causes or brands. I'm not here to talk about psychology of sharing. However, what I'm here to talk about is that many companies nowadays are actually trying to leverage social media in order to increase their reach. So they're trying to increase their purchases, they're trying to increase the engagement with their brand by using the social networks of their customers. And moreover, many companies have started to offer monetary incentives for people to share, hoping that that will increase even further their reach. And then a number of different incentives that you can find online with different companies. I'm just going to show you two different examples here. One is about LoveFilm, which is kind of like Netflix for Europe. It's an Amazon company that offers video rentals. And their incentive is, if you get one of your friends to sign up, that friend gets 2 months for free and you get 10 euro. And you can consider many different scenarios here. So there can be different amounts of the incentive, different amounts of the reward for both people. I will actually discuss some of the different variables in such an incentivized sharing scenario. This is an example for... this doesn't appear. So this is actually Fab. Fab is supposed to appear here, but it doesn't. Fab has designer items online, and they have tiered incentives for sharing with users. And you can see some of the examples here. At Living Social, we have an incentive which is called Me Plus 3. It's a post-purchase incentive which basically gives you a deal for free if three of your friends buy the same deal that you bought. And this is just to show you how it works. So somebody bought a deal, they shared with five friends, one friend bought, nothing happens, but if three friends buy, this guy gets the deal for free. If one more friend buys, great, we don't get another deal for free, but Living Social gets an extra referred purchase. Okay, so the big questions here, is the incentive working? Can we offer better incentives and increase profit? And third question is, can we answer these questions without launching expensive large-scale social experiments? There is very little known about how well these incentives work and what is the actual return on investment if you start searching through the literature. Okay, so is the incentive working? So what we started with was just some exploratory data analysis. We tested some hypotheses related to social network analysis. So we studied shared degree distribution, incentivized versus non-incentivized user behavior, recipient purchase probabilities, free deal probabilities, how people arrive into the system, how often they buy or wake up other people to buy. You can find more details in this paper online. I'm going to just talk about the first two briefly. One of the most studied properties, probably the most studied property of social networks, is degree distribution. And it's well known that in social networks, degree distribution follows a power law. So not surprisingly, if we look at this graph right here, which is basically the shared degree distribution of non-incentivized shares. So this is something that happens before... If you don't purchase the deal, you cannot participate in E+3. Right, so I want to distinguish between these two different types of sharing. One is incentivized and one is non-incentivized. This is non-incentivized. If you don't buy, you just share. Pure power law. And if you actually look at what happens with the incentive, is that now you're getting a broken power law. There is a shift that happens at 3. And it's due to the Me+3 incentive, because now people are more willing to share, are willing to share with more people because of the incentive. Okay? So, again, is it successful? How to compare between incentives? The first thing that you need to do if you're trying to answer this question is define meaningful metrics. And we think that the meaningful metric here is actually lifting shares due to the incentive. If you're counting all shares due to... To the incentive. If you attribute all shares to the incentive, you're probably overcounting. And I will show you one way in which you can do it. If we try to answer it by separating people between altruistic and incentivized sharing, that will probably be very hard, because it means every time a person shares, asking them, oh, are you altruistic now or incentivized? And we can't really separate without knowing what is their true intention. So there isn't an easy answer to how to separate between altruistic and incentivized. However, even if you cannot measure it at the person level, maybe you can measure it in the aggregate. Ooh, 60 seconds. Okay, cool. So here's the broken power law again. And here the hypothesis is that basically there is a shift that occurs from the power law that would have happened if there was no incentive to the incentivized sharing. So now the band between these two is actually what you get in terms of additional shares. And if you actually measure that, you notice that there is between 46 to 58% lift in shares due to the incentive. And the difference in these numbers is due to how to the different slopes that you can attach to the power law. Or the... if you actually look at it on, in a log-log scale. And so the next question was, can we offer better incentives? The space of possible incentive variables is really large. You can have, as I mentioned, various reward amounts, profit margins, thresholds for number of friends who adopt, etc., etc. Ideally, you want to run these expensive, large-scale social experiments. If you have tons of engineers who can do that, and you have tons of money to throw, do that. That's the best. What we did instead was we proposed a general network model which incorporates hypothesis of how incentives would change the observed statistical properties in the network. Then we simulate the behavior over time with n different than 3, and then we study effectiveness on profits. This is not public yet, so I can't really show you the results yet, but hopefully in another meetup. And this is just my pitch, of course. So we are hiring at Living Social. If you're interested to talk, find me after the meetup. Okay.
And there's Elena's contact information at the end there. Drew, can you come up? Next speaker is Dhruv Sharma from FDIC.
So put this on your shirt first.
Yeah, that's fine. It's been all over the place. So.
Sorry. Hi, my talk today is on credit scoring and random forests. So I'd like to start off with the sort of frame. So what would you think Roger Bannister and credit scoring would have in common? Not much at first thought, but you know, if you think about it, in the 50s, before Roger Bannister ran the mile in 3 minutes and 59 seconds, people thought it was impossible for humans to run the mile in less than 4 minutes. And similarly, in the credit scoring industry, the bulk of models that are built are done using linear models, which are subject to the flat maximum, which essentially says that the model predictive power of the models is insensitive to the regression coefficients and sample size beyond a certain point. It's sort of like an asymptote, and so it's sort of credit scoring seems to have been at a stopping point. And what's interesting is if you look at how far we've come on the mile run, in the last 50 years we've improved it by 17 seconds, and which is about a 7% lift over 4 minutes. And having looked at random forests in the credit scoring domain, that's about the increase in model performance you get with random forests. But in banking, it's a big deal. So I want to discuss random forests just as an overview. It's essentially an ensemble technique where multiple models are built using bootstrap samples from the data and a random selection of variables in each model construction. And the basis, the building block, is recursive partitioning trees. And then after hundreds of these trees are built using different samples of data, different regression variables, a majority vote is cast to classify. This is in the binary classification space. And surprisingly, random forests are a very powerful predictor. What I find most useful about them, though, is their variable importance ranking, which essentially, after the model is built, each variable is scrambled, and the degradation in the model's predictive performance is measured, and the variables are ranked by that. So, you know, that's sort of the tool. And what I found is in applying random forest to application credit scoring, which is when you try to qualify a borrower to be approved for a loan, which is typically, usually has 10 to 20 application variables, the random forest tends to beat the logistic regression model by 5 to 7%. And if you apply it to the behavior scoring domain, which can have hundreds of variables, it can have an improvement of 15 to 20%. And an example of behavior scoring is, like, if you have a credit card line, companies will mine your usage patterns and your other credit variables to see if they should increase your line or reduce your line or cut it. So to step back, I mean, what's characteristic of credit scoring data sets is credit variables are highly correlated, and p-values are not as telling given that. So typically it's been difficult, bless you, it's been difficult to find out what variables matter the most, and often people build models using different variables that are equivalent in performance. Now, here's an example of the Pacific Asian KDD credit card data set, where this is a receiver operating curve, and I'm going to assume, you know, people are familiar with it, but just as a quick overview, the x-axis is the false positive rate, the y-axis is the true positive rate, and the higher area under the curve you have, the more predictive the model. The green curve is, in this data set, if you applied logistic regression to it, the performance you would get. The random forest performance is this blue line, which is higher. And then there's this red line, which I'll talk about. Essentially, what I've found is if you take the most important variables from the random forest variable importance and test out interaction effects with the other variables, and add them to the logistic regression, you can end up with a logistic regression that is equivalent to the random forest in terms of performance, or sometimes slightly better. And so I dubbed this approach the I-star algorithm, you know, in spirit, in reference to the A-star algorithm for those who are into that. But I obviously stands for interaction effect. But it essentially loops through the variable, the topmost variables in the random forest rankings, does a one-way interaction effect against the other variables, and in a validation set, tests out each interaction, builds them up, and only keeps the variable if it increases out-of-sample performance. And having done that on various data sets, here's just some stats on three. On the German credit data, you know, the original logistic regression had an area under the curve of 0.81. Random forest had a 0.83. And then this algorithm resulted in a 0.88 area under the curve. And this is on the holdout set, the third set. And again, for the credit card data set that we just looked at, you know, the improvement went from 0.6 to 0.62 in random forest and 0.64 in the modified logistic regression, and similarly for the home equity data set. So to conclude, random forests appear to outperform logistic regression and credit data sets where there are, in fact, predictive interaction effects. Now, if you encounter a data set where these interaction effects have no value, and, then obviously random forest won't outperform logistic regression. So one general way you could use this is run the random forest, and if it dominates, then you can know that it's worthwhile to search for interaction effects, and then go back and do that. So, there.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Natalie Robb.
This way.
On the other side.
Should be set. Yes, spacebar or
Hi, my name is Natalie Robb, and I'm a principal in a company called Wavelength Data Market Analytics. And what my presentation is about today is analyzing data exhaust. And I don't know how familiar you are with what data exhaust is, but it's basically a byproduct of normal operations. So in this case, we were analyzing network data traffic that that results from a carrier IP service switch. So I don't know how much you all know about carrier networks, but every neighborhood has them. And it's the edge of the network where it distributes the traffic to the user. So long about 2008, a hardware vendor came to us and they asked us if there was value in looking at network management data to see if it had value to marketing. So in this particular, one of our very first pilot projects was Canada. We were looking at Toronto versus Montreal. So, and if you notice that source data, it was all just aggregated traffic flows. So what they gave us in 2008, they gave us 28 carrier switches evenly distributed between Toronto and Montreal. And for that entire time, it was the entire population and all the users on the network with all their data flowing all the time. It was specifically every 6 seconds. It wasn't constant. So we got subscriber data, the IP address, the application code, and the application code would be something that represented, it would either be a network protocol like HTTP, or it would be an application code like Microsoft Office. We also got a variable that looked at the amount of traffic that came in, as well as the amount of traffic that came out of an IP address. And, of course, a time and date stamp. So the important thing here is that it looked at a subscriber IP address. It didn't look at what an individual was doing unless it was looking at a mobile device, which then tracks straight to an individual. So from all of this source data that came from the network, we had millions of traffic records, which through the magic of ETL, we transformed into a per-subscriber view. And between the two cities, it was about 400,000 users, and we put it into different times of day to analyze it and created thousands of variables, as you can imagine. And then a lot of the transformations were looking at what happens over the time period. So, for example, we looked at, is there a time of day in which somebody is using streaming? So just to give some very high-level conclusions about what we saw in the data. And so the question was, does it have value in marketing? And so I'm going to answer that right now and say yes. And you can tell when you just ran the first distributions that Toronto was very different than Montreal. Remember, Toronto is a lot bigger than Montreal, but Montreal still had a greater percentage of users within the pilot period. So, again, our objective was to look at broadband usage habits. So to do that, we put them in segments. You all hear about bandwidth hogs. Well, and you hear about, well, you might not if you're not in technology and telecom, but I'm assuming a lot of folks here are familiar with technology. So the highest 5% of users, we call the hogs, they consume nearly 44% of traffic. The next 15% we call the power users, and they consume about 32%. So the 80-20 rule was really very much at work in this data set. We did this analysis over many countries throughout the latter part of the last decade, and it was very consistent on the 80-20 rule. So going back to the hogs are a real problem. They consume 8 times the average of all the users on the network, and so they're really expensive. And then the other thing that we identified in our segment analysis, that power users were really the most dynamic. They used voice over IP, they used more innovative services and protocols faster than anybody else. So the big lesson to this particular service provider is that you really want to nurture your power users, and you want to keep them because they help develop your new markets, but they don't destroy network performance quite like the hogs do. And then, of course, the lowest 40%, the barely users that use about 2% of network resources, these guys are just paying the bill and then add to your profit margin, so you're really glad to have them. So the fundamental question, is Toronto different than Montreal? And clearly the answer is yes, it is. in Montreal, they had a lot more of the barely users, and those were the, remember, those are the ones who barely touched their internet connection. And then the hogs are about even in each city, and Toronto had more power users and up-and-comers. So the one conclusion that we could make from it is that people in Montreal have more to do than sit around and play on the internet. So they didn't have the same application penetration levels either. And we looked at a lot of different applications, and a lot of them I couldn't show you, but these ones. So the obvious ones, enterprise apps and HTTP, those are about the same. Because after all, who doesn't use Microsoft Word and who doesn't surf the net? So, but from there, there were some real divergences. People in Toronto stream more, they game more, and they watch video online significantly more. And so streaming and video, what is different about Toronto versus Montreal?
Language.
Yes, language. There's a lot more content in English for streaming and video. And peer-to-peer ended up being the biggest difference. And P2P would be the applications like BitTorrent and Nutella and eDonkey. And those are usually used for content delivery. So so the people in Toronto are downloading illegal content like Don't Tomorrow. So if you looked at this information and you superimposed it with the segments, what you would find is that the hogs are the biggest offenders, of course, of P2P. So we had to come up with a way to find them. So, and to do this, we created a P2P offender score. It was the overall composite that is based on two key logical assumptions, and that is you need to index a user's total to their overall average of everybody on the network so you could really identify who's significantly above average, and then a ratio to show how much of a user's traffic is actually P2P. And then we could tie it to network conditions to be able to say, okay, if this person's, if network conditions are really slow and the P2P composite is almost done, is really high, then you need to put a bandwidth cap on it. So, just to wrap this up, we definitely could find differing broadband user habits, and it does have value in marketing, and it has value in other things, and we'll let you guys figure that out. But it was crucial to them to control P2P traffic to make sure that everybody had a consistent quality of user experience. And it is in use today. It's, the technology, of course, has been transitioned, and it's used to enforce those nasty bandwidth caps that we all hate. So, on that.
Okay, our next speaker is Tommy Jones from STPI.
Jones!
Put this on somehow. Okay, so hello. My name is Tommy Jones. I'm a statistician at the Institute for Defense Analysis, Science and Technology Policy Institute. The Science and Technology Policy Institute is a federally funded research and development center that supports primarily the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy, as well as other federal agencies in the executive branch. That's our elevator speech. Try rehearsing that a lot without tripping over your words. So I'm here today to talk about consensus clustering. So first, sort of a review of clustering for those that may not know. Clustering is an unsupervised algorithm where you're trying to perform the task to assign points to groups called clusters in such a way that points in one cluster are more similar to each other than they are to points in any other cluster. Now, clustering is a completely unsupervised method. What that means is we don't have an answer set or a test set where after we've run points through the clustering algorithm, we can then go check the answers that our algorithm gave us compared to what we know the true answers are. In the real world, that can create a problem in finding a robust clustering solution. So one, if your data has significantly more than three features, which means it would be represented in more than three-dimensional space, visual inspection is going to be very difficult. Two, boundaries between clusters can be blurry or even non-existent. And three, and probably most importantly to this talk, different clustering algorithms, of which there are many, have different idiosyncrasies. So under certain conditions, I can have a clustering algorithm that works really well at discovering the pattern of my data. And under other conditions, it will work really, really poorly. But because clustering is totally unsupervised, I don't actually know when my clustering algorithm is working really, really well or really, really poorly. So, this is sort of where consensus clustering comes in. Consensus clustering is the cluster analog to an ensemble classifier. So if you remember, one of our presenters just talked about random forest. That's an ensemble classifier, where you take predictions from multiple different models and you combine them together, and you either make them vote, you take an average, you do something like that, to get a single prediction that hopefully works better than any one of those models by themselves. Consensus clustering is no different. You take the output of multiple different clustering algorithms, you combine them together to get a single clustering solution that you hope is more representative of the pattern underlying your data. So, of the handful of consensus clustering algorithms that I've come across, the one I'm choosing to speak about is this cluster-based similarity partitioning algorithm, or CSPA. And so the reason I chose that one is not because I necessarily think it's the best algorithm. I mean, I've used it to some success and I like it, but it's also the most intuitive. It's the one that you would reach to first when you're thinking about, how would I tackle this problem? But speaking of things being intuitive, a quick caveat, I present the math here a little bit differently than Strel and Ghosh do in their paper, and that's for ease of understanding the concept. So if you code this up the way I show it to you, you might be degrading your performance a little bit. They've got a slick way of combining all the data in a couple quick steps. So the first thing you want to do, you've got output from multiple different clustering algorithms. We'll say R algorithms, for those of you who can't see the subscript there. You've got output from R different clustering algorithms. I'm going to represent each one as a square matrix, where if I'm clustering n different points, the square matrix has n rows and n columns. And the ij entry of this matrix is going to be 1 if point I and point J were in the same cluster, and it's going to be 0 if point I and point J were in a different cluster. So obviously you've got ones running down the main diagonal there. So do represent all of your clustering solutions this way. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to... I guess it's a little formatting issue. Those boxes. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to create a new similarity matrix that's essentially an average of all of these 0-1 cluster assignment matrices. That's called S. So you add them all up, you divide by the number of matrices you have, and you're left with this matrix here on the bottom, S, where the ij entry is the share of times that point I and point J were in a clustering solution together. And one would hope also that BLB ones down the main diagonal, if you end up with a point that's assigned in two different clusters and you're partitioning your data, you might want to go back and check your code there. And so finally, this similarity matrix gets used as an input to whatever your favorite clustering algorithm is. So normal k-means clustering, you would use Euclidean distance to calculate the distance or similarity as the input for your clustering algorithm. Well, instead, we're going to use S. And so I'm not sure how I'm doing on time, but if I have time, I'll explain what's actually... Harlow, give me a thumbs up. Okay, so this is a picture of a document clustering problem where what we did was, rather than choosing multiple different clustering algorithms, we stuck with a K-medoids algorithm, which is very similar to K-means, except using cosine similarity and
instead of a center, an average you calculate, you just represent one of the documents as the center of a cluster. So we iteratively subset our data in such a way that we took away some documents every time. We were calculating frequencies of the words in the documents in such a way that they were scaled by which words were available in the data space at which frequency. So by removing documents and then recalculating these frequencies, we're essentially adding a little bit of noise every single time we resampled. We took some documents away and we reclustered them. We did this 100 times and then plotted them as a graph. So instead of using S just as sort of a similarity matrix, thought of it as an adjacency matrix. How closely connected are these two documents? Plotted those up like that, and then we used a graph-based clustering algorithm called Chinese Whispers that, 60 seconds left, that I will leave you guys to look up for yourself. But that's what's giving the colors in our cluster there. So a couple notes on CSPA. One, as I said before, it's really intuitive. So for those of you doing client work, your clients may not be as quantitatively inclined. If you are presenting to other coworkers who may not be quantitatively inclined, it's easy to explain to them what's going on. A lot easier in random forest, I can promise you that much. So far we talked about hard clustering where everything's a partition. It's also extendable to soft clustering. Soft clustering being where every point is given some sort of share of belongingness to each cluster. Leaving the math of that to you guys as well. A caveat, it's the time complexity of this algorithm, according to Strel and Grosch, I didn't independently verify that, increases quadratically compared to the size of your data set. So if you have several hundred thousand points or a million points, maybe not the most efficient algorithm. But like I said, it's intuitive, so that has some draw for those of us that work with clients. And that's all for me. So.